This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
So tonight I'm basically going to continue a sort of series of talks that I've been giving here on different types of Buddhism. Seems to have been what's happened, so I'm going with that. So, for example, last time I was here, I talked about a style or a school of Buddhism, usually called a Huayan Buddhism or Avatamsaka Buddhism. Many people haven't heard of it, that's why I like to talk about it. A few times before that, I talked about devotional Buddhism or Pure Land Buddhism. Talked about a philosophical school of Buddhism called Yogacara. And so tonight, we're going to talk about Zen, which is probably one of the most popular brands, forms, styles of Buddhism. Again, what exactly Zen is a little elusive. Depending on who you talk to, you'll get five different definitions of what Zen is, what Zen Buddhism is. So this is going to be sort of my version of it. It comes across in the form of a story. So this, the first part of this will be a nice little story to help kind of introduce the history of Zen, but also to try to give you a little feel for Zen, but for, again, at least what I think of it as. So the hero of this story is an unsung hero, a Chinese Buddhist monk named Shen Hui. Very, very few people have heard of Shen Hui, which is unfortunate, since he really should get all of the credit for having created Zen Buddhism. Again, he was a Chinese Buddhist monk, lived from about 670 to 740, 750. He was an old guy when he died, lived a very long time. And the story actually takes place in the year 732. In the spring. And what was going on, and you need a little background in order to kind of really get what's going on here. If you didn't know, Buddha, the founder of the tradition, is born in India around 400 BC, 500 BC, give or take a century. Buddhism comes to China around the year zero. Definitely in the first few decades of what we call the Common Era. And so 732, Buddhism's been in China for 732 years at that point, has been on Earth longer than 1,000 years at that point. So it's a very old tradition, Buddhism. It's a very old tradition at that point, and had become a deep part of Chinese culture and Chinese society. But different forms of Buddhism. The more devotional form that I've spoken about in the past, really a deep reverence for the Buddha and actually for Buddhas, many Buddhas. Belief in the Buddha's omniscience, all-knowingness, omnipotence, all-powerfulness. This was sort of big in China. They had a very particular kind of idea about who the Buddha was, what the Buddha was. All different types of Buddhism, right? And in the year 732, which happens to be right in the middle of the Tang Dynasty, the Tang Dynasty is kind of this high point of Buddhist culture in China, where there was like a monastery on every block, temples everywhere. You see Buddhist monks and Buddhist nuns everywhere. So very popular. And in the year 732, China was actually being ruled by a woman, the first and only time that China has been ruled by a woman, and only a woman. You had lots of very powerful empresses who sort of ruled, but the emperor was sitting on the throne and, you know, all of that. But this was actually the first time where a woman said, no, I, as empress, will rule the country. Her name was, her surname, her family name was Wu, Empress Wu Zetian. And it was in the year 732 that she was the empress ruling China and really, really supporting Buddhism. She was really into Buddhism. Well, actually, what she did is she found this really obscure Buddhist text, a sutra, and basically had some monks rewrite it, and that made her a incarnation of the Buddha. And she used the sutra to claim divine status as ruler, as basically a female Buddha. So she's very into Buddhism, very powerful. And in order for your monastery or your temple to get funding from the government, support in different forms, you needed to go to the ruler, and many times you had to go to the emperor or the empress, and argue for the validity of your Buddhism, for your temple, what you were pushing, your style. And if the ruler, the emperor, or the empress liked it, you would get some funding, and you could build a new pagoda, or copy more sutras, or get some more monks. And so in the year 732, this monk, Shen Hui, came up from the south. He was from the south of China, and he came up to the capital of Luoyang, and he went before the empress Wu Zetian to argue his case for his type of Buddhism. One more thing you need to know before I kind of get into the real story. There's this global phenomena that, this is sort of a bit of an aside, but there's this really strange global phenomena of northerners dominating southerners. Whether it's Africa, whether it's North and South America, whether it's North America, there's this strange global phenomena where northerners claim a certain superiority over southerners and then go south and take their resources and try to subjugate them. It's a very, if you're a historian or study world history, it's a very strange phenomena that did not escape China. Meaning that northern China was always sort of considered by the northerners, of course, better, more noble in some way. And then they would go down into the southern regions, go down into what is now Vietnam, and basically take all the resources they wanted and claimed a certain superiority over southerners. Right? This is an important part of this story. When this southern monk, Shen Hui, goes north to the capital to argue for his kind of country bumpkin style Buddhism down in the south. And he needs money for his monastery. And so he goes before Empress Wu Zetian and he bows before her and does all the necessary protocols before the ruler. And she asks him, well, why should I fund your monastery? Why should I fund your Buddhism? And he says, well, because I'm the seventh patriarch, the seventh leader of the southern school of Zen sudden enlightenment. That's why. And the Empress Wu Zetian says, the who of the what of the where? Like, what are you talking about? What is this Zen business? Seventh patriarch of what? And you're from where? No. That, and he steps back. You haven't heard about the southern school of Zen, sudden enlightenment Buddhism? You haven't heard about it? And she's like, no, I haven't heard about it. Well, let me tell you about it. So he tells the Empress Wu Zetian a story. And the story is about his master, the sixth patriarch of the southern school of Zen, sudden enlightenment. And she goes, well, I've never heard of the sixth patriarch. And he says, well, the sixth patriarch was named Hui Neng. And Hui Neng was from the south. And he was a country boy, illiterate. And his father died when he was very, very young. And he was raised by his mother. And he spent all of his days chopping firewood. Out in the woods, chopping firewood. And then he would take the firewood and go into the city and sell it for money and bring it back. And that's how him and his widow mother survived. Until one day he was strolling through the village with his bundle of wood, and he happened to overhear a monk reciting lines from a Buddhist text, a sutra, that's usually called the Diamond Sutra. And if you don't know about the Diamond Sutra, also called the Vajra Chetaka Sutra, it's a very deep, very philosophical Buddhist text that's all about non-duality and emptiness. Non-duality, being that these distinctions that we make between good, bad, yes, no, high, low, tall, skinny, all these different adjectives and ideas are all dualisms of the mind that are created in the mind. And actually underlying everything in reality is actually nothingness. That everything depends on everything else to be what it is. That tallness relies on shortness and beautiness relies on ugliness and so on and so forth. So everything is ultimately underneath it, empty. And Hui Neng, walking along with his wood, he hears this Diamond Sutra. He hears this amazing message of non-duality and emptiness, and bam, it hits him. And he is suddenly enlightened, fully enlightened to all of the Buddha's teachings based on hearing one line from the Diamond Sutra. And he goes running up to the monk, and he goes, "What is that amazing poetry you're reading? What is that? I've never heard such things." And the monk says, "It's the Diamond Sutra." "You haven't heard the Diamond Sutra?" And the monk's like, and Hui Neng's like, "No, I'm illiterate. I've never read anything." And he goes, well, you got to get into this because this is where it's at. And he's like, "Well, where do I get into that? What's that all about?" And he says, "Well, my master is from the north, from East Mountain Monastery. And he practices Zen meditation and he preaches the Diamond Sutra." And Hui Neng says, "Well, then I want to go to East Mountain Monastery and study Zen and learn all about the Diamond Sutra." So he goes home and says, "Sorry, Mom, I've been called to higher duty." And he packs up his bag and he starts heading north. And he goes to East Mountain Monastery. And he goes all the way, pilgrimages all the way to the top of East Mountain Monastery. And he goes and he demands to see the fifth patriarch named Hong Ren. Hong Ren is the abbot of this monastery, has been the abbot for decades, and he has all of his students in front of him, and all of a sudden, Hui Neng, this country kid from the south, comes walking up with his little bag, and he walks up to the abbot, to Hong Ren, and he says, you guys make Buddhas here, right? I want to be a Buddha. I'm in for that. I read the line from the Diamond Sutra. I'm in." And the fifth patriarch, Hong Ren, he looks this kid up and down, and he says, "Yeah, I see, but you're from the south, right?" And Hui Neng's like, "Yeah." And Hong Ren says, "Nothing good ever comes from the south. There's no way you could be a Buddha." And Hui Neng says, "Well, I may come from the south, and you may come from the north, but as I understand the teachings of the Buddha, there's no difference in our Buddha nature." And then, so then Hong Ren, the abbot, he takes a step back and he goes, "Oh, it's like that." And he says, "Yeah, that's pretty good, but if you want to become a monk here, you got to put in your time." And so he sends Hui Neng off to the kitchen to pound rice, right? And so Hui Neng, he's fine, that's what I'll do. So he goes off in the kitchen, he starts pounding the rice, right? And so he's in there for a few weeks, and he doesn't say anything, he doesn't do anything, he just figures that's what it's all about, so he's just sitting there pounding his rice. Meanwhile, the fifth patriarch, Hong Ren, he calls a meeting of all of his students together, and he says, "Everybody, it's getting time for me to go." You know, Hong Ren was very old at that point, and all of these Buddhist masters, they can see the end of their life coming, like, weeks and months away, so they know, like, to the hour. And so he's like, "You know, it's coming soon, and I have to appoint a successor. I need to appoint who will be the sixth patriarch. And so I want all of you, all of my students, to write what is called a mind verse. A very small poem that demonstrates your level of enlightenment. And whoever writes the most enlightened, the most brilliant mind verse will be my successor." And so all the little students go running off, and they'll go off back to the dorm, and they're wondering what they're going to write, and they're sitting there. And meanwhile, there is the headmaster of the monastery, a guy named Shen Xu, right? He was sort of the second in command, the teacher of the students, the headmaster of the school. And all the students were sitting there saying to one another, "Well, I'm not going to write a mind verse because Shen Xu, he's a shoo-in, right? He's the second in command. He's our head teacher. He's obviously slated to be the next patriarch. I'm not even going to bother writing a poem." And the other monks are like, well, I'm not going to bother writing a poem either. There's no way I can get it. If he doesn't think he can get it, yeah, Shen Shu's probably going to get it. Meanwhile, Shen Shu's back in his little dormitory, sitting there pulling his hair out because he can't think of anything to write. Yeah, sure, he's number two in charge. Sure, he's the headmaster. But he's sitting there going, crumbling it up, writing another one, crumbling it up. He's like, I don't have it. Then he has an idea. He goes, ooh, I know. And so that night, he goes sneaking out into the courtyard where there's this, like a shoji screen, like a freestanding screen. And it's going to be painted the next day, but that night, it was perfectly white, all three panels. And so this headmaster, Shen Shu, he says, I know what I'll do. I'll write a poem on this. And tomorrow, if the abbot, if Hong Ren, if he likes it, I'll say I did it. But if he doesn't like it, I can pretend like I didn't write it. So he writes this poem. Pretty smart guy, right? So then he writes this poem. And the poem goes something like this. He says, the body is the Bodhi tree, is the tree of enlightenment. And our mind is like a mirror bright. And every day we have to polish it in order to allow the light to shine. A very loose translation of this poem. That our body is the Bodhi tree and our mind is a mirror bright. Every day we have to polish it to let it shine light. Right? So he writes that out and he goes back. And the next day there's all this commotion because somebody wrote a poem on the screen. And all the students are huddling around it. Ooh, ooh, and they don't know who did it. Did you do it? Oh, did you do it? I don't know who did it. Who did it? And eventually, Hong Ren, fifth patriarch, the abbot, he comes walking out, and all the students stand to the side, and he looks, and he reads it, and he nods his head, and he goes, this is good. And so Shen Shu, he goes, it was mine, I did it. And Hong Ren nods his head and says, it's very good, but it's not fully enlightened. Shen Shu goes, darn. And he says, but it's very good. There is wisdom in here. I want all you students to memorize this poem. This is a very good poem with a very good message, so everybody should memorize it. So all the students say yes, and they start, the mind is body, Bodhi tree, the mind is very good, so they all memorize it. Later that day, our hero, Hui Neng, he's back in the kitchen pounding his rice, and one of the students goes walking by the kitchen, and he's chanting to himself the poem. The body is a Bodhi tree, the mind is very good, every day we have time, da 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 da. And all of a sudden, Hui Neng hears it, and he starts laughing. Ah! And the monk stops, and he goes in the kitchen, and he says, what are you laughing at? And he says, that poem, that's ridiculous. He's like, what do you mean that's ridiculous? Our headmaster, the number two in charge, Shen Shu, wrote that. And the abbot, the fifth patriarch, Hong Ren, said it was really smart and told us we should all memorize it. And Hui Neng, shaking his head, he's like, well, I don't know why he did that, because that's not enlightened at all. He's like, I've got a poem. And the kid, the little student kid's looking at him like, what? He's like, I got a poem. He's like, but I don't know how to write. So he asks the student, he says, will you write my poem for me? And he goes, yeah. And so they go to the screen, same screen where the first poem was, and Hui Neng gets the kid to write his poem. And Hui Neng's poem goes, there is no Bodhi tree, and there is no mirror bright, because everything is emptiness. Where could dust possibly settle? And so the kid's like, wow. And so he writes that next to the other poem. And then the next day, all the students gather around because there's this other poem. And ooh, who wrote the other poem? What's going on? Da, da, da. And all of a sudden, the abbot Hong Ren comes striding out. And he reads the poem. And he goes, now that is enlightened. Who wrote that? And everybody's quiet. And then all of a sudden, the one student one goes, it was the kid in the kitchen. And so they all go rushing into the kid in the kitchen, and the abbot's like, did you write that poem? And he's like, yeah, I did. And he's like, that's very good. And so he looks at him, and he gives him a very funny look. And Hui Neng just nods. And then all the students disperse. But Hui Neng knew what the master was thinking, and so that night, very late at night, Hui Neng goes sneaking into Hong Ren's private quarters, the abbot's quarters, because he got the message that he wanted to see him. And so he invites him in and he says, your poem was very good. A demonstration of non-duality and emptiness. Very enlightened. And he says, and because you demonstrated the most enlightened mind verse, I am going to make you the sixth patriarch. But first, I'm going to tell you a story. And so, Hong Ren proceeds to tell Hui Neng a story. And the story goes something like this. He says, many hundreds of years ago, there was a monk from the south of India whose name was Bodhidharma. And Bodhidharma was the son of a priest. And he got on a boat when he was in his early 20s and he sailed to the south of China. And he went to a very tall mountain named the Little Forest, Shaolin, as you might know it. So he goes to the top of Mount Shaolin and he finds a cave. And he begins to practice his dhyana meditation that he brought from the south of India. And he sat in this cave. They say he sat in this cave for like 9 years. And he sat facing a wall with his nose an inch from the wall, just staring at the wall for 9 years. They say that he cut off his own eyelids to stay awake, and that he planted the eyelids in the ground in front of him, and the first tea plant sprung up, and he plucked the leaves and made tea so he could stay awake in the cave. They say he meditated so long his arms and his legs fell off, right? They say he meditated so... Legends of Bodhidharma. There are many legends about how badass of a meditator Bodhidharma was, right? He's so bad. One day, he's sitting there in his cave, and he's deep in meditation, and a band of robbers come by. Three guys, right? And they're going looking for something to pillage, right? And they go and they look inside this cave and they see this funny guy sitting there with his nose an inch from the wall sitting there. And they're like, hey, check this guy out. What's he all about? I don't know. So they go over to him and they kind of nudge him a little bit. And he just sits there. And so then they start pushing him. And the more they push him, he just popped right back up. Just sat in meditation. Then they bring out the big guns, grab some tree branches and really start pounding on the guy. And he just sits there, immovable. Then they bust out the gasoline, the kerosene, whatever it is, drench the guy, and light him on fire. And he's just sitting there, completely immovable, unaffected. And this freaked the guys out, and they go running away, because they figured this guy's a witch, figured something is not right. So they go running away, all except for one guy, a guy named Hui Ke. Hui Ke was very impressed by this guy who could withstand such abuse, withstand fire. And so, after the fire had gone out and Bodhidharma was still sitting there, eventually, Hui Ke gets up enough nerve and he goes into the cave and he bows down, kowtows to Bodhidharma and he says, I want to be your student. I want to be able to do that. Whatever you've figured out, I want to be able to do that. And so Bodhidharma, again, after like 9 years, eventually opens up his eyes, or he doesn't have the eyelids, so I guess they were wide open. Inconsistency. So he looks at him, and he looks up Hui Ke up and down, and he says, I'll take you as my student, but first, you must bring me your sin. And so Hui Ke scratches his head, and he walks out of the cave, and he says, my sin? What does he mean by that? And so he's thinking about it, and he's like, well, it's like I have been a robber and a pillager and a thief, and the punishment, traditionally in China, the punishment for thievery is having your arm cut off. That's part of the deal. Eye for an eye, you steal something, you get your arm cut off. So he figured that was his sin, and so he figures, well, all right. And so he takes his own arm, puts it on a block, pulls out a giant knife, and cuts off his own arm. And he picks it up, and he brings it to Bodhidharma, and he puts it down in front of him, and he says, will you take me as your student? And Bodhidharma, he looks down at the arm, kind of shakes his head, like, clearly this guy didn't get it. And so then he looks at Hui Ke, and he says, I will take you as my student, but next, you must bring me your ignorance. And so Hui Ke walks away, and he's kind of like, ignorance, what does And so he figures he wants to chop off his head. No, he can't want me to chop off my head. That's crazy. Chopped off my arm. What does this guy want? Finally, he can't figure it out. He's totally perplexed. And so he goes up to Bodhidharma and he says, I don't understand. I don't understand what you mean, but I want to be your student. And Bodhidharma says, great, take you as my student. So he accepted his own ignorance. And so he takes Huayka as his student and begins to train him in dhyana meditation, deep meditation, of which there are many levels and layers of dhyana meditation. Four, to be exact, four stages of this deep meditation. So he teaches Huayka all of this, and eventually, like, he's feeling like Huayka is ready. And so, late one night, he calls Huayka into his private chamber, and he says, I came here from India, but I'm starting, you know, a school here, a school of meditation, and I want to make you my first student here. And he said, but first you have to understand what this Zen Buddhism, this Dhyana Buddhism, is really all about. And so I'm going to tell you a story. And so that night, Bodhidharma tells Huayka this story. And he says, many, many, many hundreds of years ago, in the long distance past, about 400 BC or so, back in India at the time of the Buddha, there was a great event. It was going to be the Buddha's final sermon, his final sutra, his final teaching. He was getting ready to die. He too had seen the end coming. And so he called all of his students together. And so all the 500 arhats came, and all the monks and nuns came, and all the bodhisattvas, and all the kinaras, and all the gandharavas, and all the asuras, and all everybody came. I mean, this was going to be the Buddha's big final sermon. Everybody was there. Nagas, Naga kings, you name it. Everybody, a packed house. And the Buddha was sitting there deep in a samadhi, another type of meditation, an even deeper meditation. And he was sitting in his deep samadhi as everybody gathered around, and everybody was so excited because, I mean, this was going to be it. He was going to drop the bomb on all of them, right? Forget about all those other sutras. This was going to be the final, ultimate one, the truth absolute. And so he was in his deep meditation, and everybody was sitting there, he's getting ready, shh. And so then the Buddha woke from his meditation and simply did this. And there was one monk named Kashyapa who was sitting near the front. And as the Buddha twisted a flower in between his fingers, this one monk Kashyapa slightly smiled, just a little smile. And at that moment, the Buddha made a direct mind-to-mind transmission of the true Dharma eye, the true teachings that are beyond words and letters. And it was because Kashyapa understood the meaning of the Buddha's final sutra, his final sermon, that Kashyapa became the first patriarch of Zen Buddhism. And Kashyapa then passed the true Dharma eye, the direct transmission, mind to mind, to his student, Ananda. And Ananda passed it to his student, who passed it to his student, who passed it to his student, through a series of 27 patriarchs in India. Till finally, Bodhidharma was given the direct mind to mind transmission. And he took that to China. And he sat in his cave, and then he eventually took Huayka as his student, and he passed the direct mind-to-mind transmission on to Huayka. And Huayka passed it on to his student, and his student passed it on to his student, and that student passed it on to Hong Ren. And Hong Ren is sitting in his chamber with Hui Nung, and he says, and therefore I pass on to you, Hui Nung, the direct mind-to-mind transmission of the true Dharma eye, and I make you the sixth patriarch. And therefore you see, Empress Wu Zetian, that my teacher, Hui Nung, passed on to me the direct mind-to-mind transmission of the true Dharma eye. So it really, really would benefit you to fund my monastery. Now, that's the kind of the shorter story of this Zen Buddhism thing. Now, eventually, Wu Zetian was not totally impressed by this story. Okay, she was interested in the story, but eventually she asked, okay, that's all well and fine, direct mind-to-mind transmission, true dharma, but what do you do? You know, that's fine what you believe all of that stuff, but what do you do? And so then, Shenhui begins to describe his style of Zen meditation. He says, well, at our monastery, all the monks meditate, and that's all that we do. That was the prescription of the Buddha, to sit in meditation. And so we sit in meditation. And Empress Wu Zetian says, yeah, but you Buddhists get a bad reputation. A lot of people think that you're just social parasites leeching off of the working class. And Hui Neng says, well, at our school, a day without work is a day that you don't eat. All the monks at our monastery put in their daily labor. We grow our own food. And now Empress Wu Zetian's like, well, I like that aspect of it, right? And so eventually, through all of this, through the practice and the belief, Shenhui convinces the Empress to fund his type of Zen Buddhism, the Southern School of Sudden Enlightenment. And then Shenhui has a student and passes it on. And eventually it gets passed along until there becomes a Japanese form of this school, and so on and so forth, until the modern era, when there is a Zen school, many, many Zen schools, okay? That's the sort of the story that I want to work with tonight, all right, for the next little bit. Any questions about the story? Yeah, I know. Maybe. I'm going to draw out a few things from this story that I think are relevant to understanding what Zen is. You might be more confused now of what Zen is, but somebody, hi.
This is the first time I hear that Zen being titled the Buddhism that directly came from.
Yeah. I'm glad you asked that, because that's one of the aspects of what makes Zen Buddhism Zen Buddhism. So there are many aspects. I started with an essential aspect, which is that this word Zen means dhyana, which is a type of meditation. So we know that this school is steeped in meditation. Fine. Show me a school of Buddhism that's not steeped in meditation. Right? Fine. But what makes Zen very unique is this particular idea that there is an unbroken chain that goes all the way back to the Buddha. That there's this idea, and it exists in all Zen schools, of which there are many, many branches that split off. But all of them are united in this idea that there was this direct mind-to-mind transmission of something, some wisdom, some knowledge, some enlightenment, that the Buddha sort of like directly conveyed to Kashyapa. And what the Zen tradition says of itself is that it is a special transmission of the Dharma without reliance on words and letters. That it is an unspoken transmission. That you don't need to read sutras, you don't need to do all of that, but an enlightened master can kind of just turn you on and make you enlightened. And so that is part of the Zen lore, the folklore of Zen Buddhism, is that there is this unbroken chain that goes all the way back to the Buddha. And so one of the things that I want to emphasize tonight about what is Zen is uniquely a Chinese type of Buddhism, all right? This stuff about direct mind-to-mind transmission, the stuff about 28 patriarchs and then 6 Chinese patriarchs, all of that, the patriarch stuff, you would never find any of that in India or Indian Buddhism. It is a uniquely Chinese fixation with the sage, with the masters of old. Okay, so that this emphasis on the enlightened master is a very Chinese thing. And this idea of a direct mind-to-mind transmission is a very unique Chinese thing. And one of the things that it was happening in China was a search for authority, a search for legitimacy. What do a bunch of Chinese people know about an Indian religion? That was a big question that was floating around China in the year 732, and actually had always been floating around China. What do a bunch of Chinese people know about an Indian religion that was originally preached in, they thought Sanskrit. We know better now that it wasn't Sanskrit, but an Indian language. And the answer to that question of what do a bunch of Chinese people know? Well, what they know is the direct mind-to-mind transmission. In other words, Huineng, Hongren, Bodhidharma, these Chinese masters are as enlightened as the Buddha. You don't need to make a pilgrimage back to India. You don't need to read the sutras in their original language. You don't need to study under a monk from India or whatever. You can study under a Chinese born and bred person, and that their enlightenment is no different than any other enlightenment. Right? Now, what I want to point out, though, is that this need, if you will, for authority and legitimacy, it still goes on today, right? Any meditation teacher, kind of Buddhist teacher in the United States has their ordination certificate. And on their ordination certificate, it says that so-and-so dubbed this person worthy of teaching. And the reason why that person is worthy of being able to dub somebody else worthy is because they were dubbed worthy. And they were dubbed worthy, and they were dubbed worthy, and eventually it goes back to the Buddha, and so, okay, fine. You win, right? You can teach the Dharma because Buddha said so, right? But it's an interesting phenomena that has happened repeatedly throughout the history of Buddhism. What gives you the right to sit up there and talk about Buddhism?
Is Japanese Zen versus Chinese Zen practiced differently? And is there a Taoist influence or fusion in Zen?
So, here's the thing about it. Zen Buddhism is really, really steeped in wisdom like the Diamond Sutra, non-duality, emptiness, and all of that. And by virtue of that, it also, early Chinese Zen, Chan Buddhism, it becomes really focused on this idea of the direct transmission outside of words and letters, meaning you don't need to read the sutras, you don't need to do all of that. You really, that this idea of sudden enlightenment, what it's emphasizing is this very basic Buddhist idea that we are all already enlightened. I'll say that again. We are all already enlightened. You don't have to work for it. You don't have to polish the mirror of your mind daily through meditation in order to get there. It's not some piece of knowledge you don't have yet, and as soon as you get it, you'll be enlightened. No, no, no. We are all already enlightened. We've forgotten that, and it's our forgetting of it that is keeping us from realizing our inherent enlightened potential. Okay? This is a very basic Mahayana Buddhist idea, and Zen Buddhist idea for that matter. And so, Zen Buddhism becomes an interesting array of tricks and techniques for getting individuals to realize their enlightened nature suddenly. Like, oh, I am enlightened, right? The example that I can use, I got enough time for this. So the good example that they use a lot is, imagine this for a moment. Imagine I have in front of me this very large pile of sand, all right, a mound of sand. And on top of the sand up here is a spigot, a water spigot. And that spigot has a leak. And so on the tip of that spigot, there form little beads of water. And those little beads of water drop onto this pile of sand and roll down the side of the pile. And in doing so, creates a little groove on the mound on the side. And then another little droplet of water drops and rolls down this side, and then another little drop of water rolls down that side. And then another drop of water falls and follows that canal made by that first drop. And because it followed that canal, it makes that canal a little deeper. And then another drop follows another canal and makes that one a little deeper. And then another drop follows canal, makes that a little deeper. And after enough drops, these series of canals have formed so that that next drop, as it falls, it doesn't have the freedom to roll this way, roll that way, roll on this side, roll on that side. It is trapped by these canals. This metaphor of the mound of sand is used to describe our minds. And that our minds, depending on the school you talk to, whether it's at birth or at some earlier incarnation, but at an earlier stage, our minds were like that perfectly round pile of sand. And these droplets of water are thoughts, ideas, feelings, emotions. But as these thoughts arise in our mind, they create canals or grooves, conditioning, if you will, conditioned thought patterns. And so as the droplets of ideas fall on the mind, they just begin to follow old patterns, old canals. And eventually, we don't even have the freedom to think of a new idea. We can't even generate a totally original, unconditioned idea. All of our ideas are conditioned, right? The bus goes by with the Doritos ad, and I'm like, oh, I feel like Doritos. Ooh, where can I get some of those? And then the neon signs, oh, I can get it over there, right? I'm following these ideas and these things that I want, but they're not really mine. They're conditioned. So the Zen, so one tradition of Buddhism says that you got to kind of rake out those grooves of the sand, and you rake it out by doing meditation. You do meditation, you calm the mind down, and there's a deconditioning that happens. Okay, this is one approach of Buddhism, which is a gradual approach to enlightenment, which is saying that if you rake out the sand, you calm the mind down enough, you think differently enough, you read sutras, think outside of the box, like eventually you can decondition the mind. And eventually you can have an original thought. And if you reach Buddha status, it's all original. Like you, no conditioning at all. You're totally free, liberated. The Zen school, though, especially the Zen school of Huainang and Bodhidharma, they're serious about this emptiness stuff. They are serious about this non-duality stuff. And they say the metaphor, the pile of sand, the grooves of the mind, it's great, but it's a metaphor, and only a metaphor. Ultimately, all of these things are empty. Ultimately, all of these things are non-dual. There is no sand. There is no mirror. There's no polishing. There's no dust. There's no defilements, right? You are all already enlightened. Wake up, the Zen master says. And so the Zen school is this idea of just trying to, jar that pile of sand. Just shake it so that all of a sudden the grooves are just fresh again. You kind of have like an earthquake of the mind. And that is an aspect of Zen. And so you get these Zen masters in China that they're mad. They're totally mad, wild guys that are trying to do the most out there thing. And so you get the students that go up to the master and they say, "Master, you know, what is what is Buddha nature? What is my Buddha nature?" Right? And the Zen master goes, "Ha!" And the student goes, "Oh." Right? Or what is the Buddha nature? And the Zen master says, "A pile of shit." And it's like, "What? Really?" There's a funny one about there's a very famous Zen master named Lin Chi. Lin Chi in Japanese, his name is Rinzai. So if you've heard of Rinzai, it comes from this guy, Lin Chi. Lin Chi is famous for having called all of his students together and said, "You're all a bunch of losers. You don't get it at all. If there's not a person in this room that can't tell me what enlightenment is," and he grabs a cat and he says, "If there's somebody in here that can't tell me what enlightenment is, I'm going to kill this cat." And he kills the cat right there, and his students are shocked. I mean, Buddhists are not even supposed to eat meat, let alone murder an innocent animal, right? It's like, oh my God. And then all of a sudden, the kid from the kitchen, not Huainang, another kid from the kitchen, a kid from the kitchen comes out, and he looks around, he sees all the blood, he sees the thing, and he looks at Master Lin Chi, and he's like, "What happened?" He says, "Well, I asked these losers what enlightenment was, and nobody could tell me." And the kid from the kitchen looks around and he goes, And when she says, "Where were you 5 minutes ago? I had to kill the cat." He actually put his shoe on his head, but I didn't have my shoe, so I put a bowl on my head. The point is that there are these stories about Zen masters doing crazy stuff that doesn't make any sense at all. And part of the game, or part of the trick of Zen Buddhism, is the idea that all of our thinking and all of our thought patterns are totally conditioned. That even logic and reason are conditioned thought patterns. And so in order to totally get outside of conditioned thinking, you need to get totally outside of the box, right? Put a shoe on your head. Some students get slapped. Some get yelled at. It's like it's different. And that's part of the idea of Zen Buddhism, is that the truth is never static. The truth is never the same one moment to the next. And so the one student walks up and says to the master, "What is the Buddha nature?" And he gets slapped, right? Next student walks up and he gets yelled at. And the next student gets up and he gets tickled, right? It's different for every person at any moment because the truth is constantly changing, right? There's a funny story about Lin Chi. Lin Chi is very famous for yelling at his students. He yelled at them a lot. It was part of his deal. And so eventually he's on his deathbed and he's giving his last sermon. And he says to his students, he says, "You know, I'm about to pass away. When I'm gone, what will you all say that my true Dharma I was? What was my true essential teaching?" And of course, he was very famous for the yelling thing. And so his most senior student stood up and he said, "Master, ha!" And Lin Chi just shook his head and said that, "I think that my Dharma I will die with this one." Meaning that the answer was not the shout. It was the shout when that guy asked, but it's the answer is not the shout. The teaching, the real teaching, arises in between the teacher and the student, that the teacher is wise enough to know where the student is, and so the truth arises in the moment between them, and a really enlightened master knows exactly what the student needs to hear, knows exactly what that student's hang-up is, and then can do just the right thing. It might be tickling, it might be yelling, it might be this, it might be that, you never know, right? So what happens is that there is this moment of wild Chinese thinking about Buddhism, where they get really wild with it, like way outside of the box, and they're burning sutras because they say you don't need the sutras anymore, and they're, you know, destroying temples, like it doesn't matter, right? But what happens, like all great heresies, what happens is that eventually the answers to the questions get written down. And the right answer and the right shout and the right tickling get written down and codified. And this tradition of this wild moment of Chinese Buddhism when they were really outside of the box gets incredibly solidified into a very, very complex tradition and gets transplanted to Japan. And eventually the Japanese the Japanese form of Zen is the type that is saying, "Ha!" Like, that is the answer, right? And so Zen Buddhism, as vibrant and wild as it may have been in the 7th, 8th century, again, kind of gets codified and solidified and institutionalized to the point where it eventually, you know, some people are like, "We're getting too institutional." And so they split off and then they become too institutional. And then it's like, "We're getting way too institutional." And somebody splits off. And so you eventually get all these different sects of Zen that are all claiming to be more authentic, true Dharma I, direct lineage through Bodhidharma, you know, all of that. And so you get all these lineages and all of this culture of Zen Buddhism go to Japan, and again, it all gets worked over again in an even more codified, solidified way, till eventually a Zen master by the name of Dogen in the 12th century, Japanese guy, he goes to China, studies there, and says, "This has gotten way out of control, all right? All of this shouting nonsense, all of this crazy talk, no. It's all about meditation." And so Dogen, this monk, he brings back to Japan kind of a final version of Zen in which he says, It's all about meditation. That's it. If you want to be a Buddha, you act like a Buddha and you sit. And so, and Dogen is, again, 12th century, mid-1100s. And so we're talking, you know, 12, 13, 1400 years after the time of the Buddha. It's a very, very long time, right? Very long history. And in my opinion, sort of as a scholar of Chinese and Japanese Buddhism, Buddhism kind of goes full circle with Dogen, where Dogen kind of brings it back to this original idea of dhyana meditation, sitting in meditation, that's what it's all about. Forget all the antics, forget all the jokes, the stories, the rituals, the this and the that. No, it's about sitting. And so the Dogen's form of Zen Buddhism becomes this deep, deep tradition of seated meditation. There's another type of Zen Buddhism that's more about the antics. Have you heard the one about the Zen master who did this, this, and that? Have you heard the one about the Zen master that did that and that? Right? And it becomes almost like knock-knock jokes that get passed around through the monks. And there's wisdom in these knock-knock jokes. You know, like if you search, you know, why did the cook put his shoe on his head? Right? Like if you search, there is wisdom in that. And those little stories about the slapping and the shoe on the head and the killing the cat, those little stories become what are known as koans. In Japanese, it's a koan. In Chinese, they call them a gong'an. And it is this funny little story that doesn't really make sense at first. And these funny little stories, these koans, get passed from teacher to student, and they become a means of testing enlightenment. Do you know why the cook put his shoe on his head, right? Do you know why Bodhidharma came to China from India? These questions that are a little enigmatic or a little confusing. The classic, what is the sound of one hand clapping, right? That's a classic koan. And again, the point of the koan, the point of Zen Buddhism, is to disrupt your normal, habituated way of thinking. Okay, so that's the definition of Zen, trying to disrupt that. The stories, the koans, that's a Zen thing. Direct mind-to-mind transmission, that's a Zen thing. The belief in the enlightenment of living masters, definitely a Zen thing, which means that I'm not going to worship a Buddha statue. I'm going to worship a living Buddha. I'm going to worship Hui Neng, these guys. And so still to this day in the Zen tradition, enlightened Zen masters by their students are considered Buddhas, enlightened beings here on earth to teach us the real Dharma, the true Dharma eye. So you can read that in a few different ways. The cynic in me, you know, wants to read this claim to authority, right? That we won't just believe Joe Schmo off the street, who, sure, he's got a nice tie on, but what does he know, right? Where's his certificate, right? So the cynic in me says, oh, Zen is just a search for authority, this claim to authority. But the not the cynic in me understands Buddhist philosophy enough to know why not. Why shouldn't an enlightened master be any different than the Buddha? Isn't that what the Buddha was talking about? Because if there's no enlightened people around, what's the point, right? Is there hope for any of us? That kind of stuff. Any questions, insights, ideas? Yes?
So the Zen tradition is what the Chinese and Japanese claim the Buddhist teaching was. But the whole, I know this Theravada is what Buddha is supposed to, it's about the mind. And then, where is Tibetan Vajrayana? Can you kind of give a scope of the other Buddhism?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's a great way to sort of tie all this together. There's this idea about Theravada, so-called Theravada being like what the Buddha taught. That's a very debated idea. For the most part, we don't know what the Buddha taught. What we have are the surviving records of one of the oldest schools called the Theravada, which is a very traditional form of Buddhism steeped in meditation, actually steeped in dhyana meditation in particular. Dhyana was the Buddha's prescription, like that type of Buddhism was the way to go. But traditionally, original Buddhism from 400 BC traditionally split into 18 different sects, 18 different schools, all debating different aspects of the Buddha's teachings. And of those 18, the Theravada were one. And so there were actually 17 other original Buddhisms. But for various historical reasons, they didn't last as long. But they are as old, if not older. So that's where it's debatable whether Theravada is like the original teaching. Anyways, so there's that. To be a Theravada Buddhist traditionally was celibacy, homelessness, and poverty. You took a vow to not live anywhere, to not have sex, and to not own anything. Beg for your food, all of that. That was sort of OG Buddhism in India. Going around. Eventually, Buddhism spreads north into what is today Pakistan and Afghanistan in that region, and becomes something very different in those regions, where the Buddha becomes something more like a god, and they start making these giant statues of Buddhas and the Buddha, and the Buddha is considered all-powerful, and you can pray to the Buddha, chant the Buddha's name, and you can get money, health, wealth, whatever you need kind of stuff. Eventually, all of that goes to China and becomes all kinds of things. But there's a type of Buddhism that originates in Nepal, the foothills of the Himalayas, and it begins with some really heavy-hitting meditator monks and nuns that were living in the foothills of the Himalayas, and they were like, yeah, I don't know what all those monks are doing down in the city there. They're getting corrupted. They're starting to have sex. They're starting to use money. Buddha told us not to use money, all that stuff. And so these kind of hardcore folks migrate up into the Himalayas and eventually spit out on the other side and wind up in Tibet. In Tibet, there was already an existing culture, an existing religion, existing rituals, all kinds of stuff that this sort of Nepalese Buddhism that spilled into Tibet mixed with. And I don't know if it's the high elevation or the fermented yak's milk that they drink or what, but Tibetan religion, Tibetan culture, and therefore Tibetan Buddhism gets really wild. It's really out there, steeped in magic and ritual. This is what is traditionally called Vajrayana, is a belief in the belief in the efficacy of ritual, meaning that if all of this is illusory anyways, then I can affect reality by making a fire and doing a ritual here. I can affect reality in other parts of the world or in my immediate environment. The Buddha supposedly was down on this type of activity, but the Tibetans seemed to not care that he was down on that type of activity, and so they get really into it. And so it's steeped in, again, ritual, magic, talismans, spells, all of that kind of stuff. So that's Tibetan Buddhism. And then all of that, the Theravada, the Vajrayana, all of the devotional forms of Buddhism, all of that spill over into China. And so China becomes this like amazing like petri dish of Buddhism where you get all kinds of it. And then it all winds up in Korea, in the Korean Peninsula. And then from the Korean Peninsula, it goes to Japan. And then from Japan to Hawaii, and from Hawaii to San Francisco, and the Beats. And that's Buddhism in a very quick nutshell. Any questions? Any? One of the things I do want to say, though, about the Zen story, though, is that it's intentionally a little confusing. Because Zen's a little confusing. Zen is, there is not one answer for what it is, and so I would never want to give one answer for what it is. I want to give you the closest approximation to the messy reality that is Zen Buddhism. That there's, again, depending on who you talk to, you'll get five different definitions, depending on what country you're talking about, depending on what century you're talking about, all of that. All right. So that's it for this evening. I want to thank everybody very, very much. I hope you enjoyed the stories and the talks and the ideas. Thank you very much.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.